The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library. My name is Esther Wax Book, a daughter of Ellis Wax, in whose memory tonight's lecture has been endowed. It is a fitting memorial for my father, who was a passionate supporter of the Free Library and its renowned author lecture series. I know that many of you here tonight have made gifts in support of programs like this. If you have not yet, we hope you will consider making a gift so that the library can continue to fulfill its mission to advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity. It is now my great pleasure to introduce our esteemed guest this evening. A former longtime columnist and foreign correspondent for the New York Times, Anand Giridharadas is a fascinating individual and groundbreaking investigational reporter who has captured the attention of many leading thinkers in this country. He is also the best-selling author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World, which was selected by numerous publications as one of the best books of the year. He is a regular on-air analyst for MSNBC, has taught journalism at New York University, and contributed articles to The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and Time magazine. In The Persuaders, Mr. Giridharadas offers enthralling insider accounts of the dissenting politicians, activists, and everyday citizens working to heal and safeguard U.S. democracy. He notes that democracy will not die by the hand of a single politician like Donald Trump, but will occur instead when people look at those they oppose politically with contempt and disgust. Only we ourselves can avoid that grim fate by recalibrating and believing that we can persuade one another to hold different viewpoints and to collaborate respectfully to forge a better future. I know we are all eager to hear his valuable insights into one of the most critical issues we face as a nation. Now, please join me in welcoming Mr. Giridharadas to the Free Library. Tonight's author will be in conversation with Tam Edwards, anchor of 6 ABC Action News, Morning Edition. Enjoy tonight.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Tam.
Hello. Welcome. And, you know, let me say the most important thing, which is go Phillies. And I know what we're all doing when this is over. But
first, also go people who choose.
Yes. To have a little enlightenment before.
Got their calendars confused and are like, oh, shit, right now. Or choose books over baseball.
Well, that's going to be a 3-4-hour game, so they can do a little bit of both. So, Anand, thank you so much for being with us to talk about your new book, The Persuaders. And there's so many things to get into that I want to talk about tonight. But, you know, first of all, the whole concept of changing someone's mind. And I think we've all dealt with these feelings sometimes. I remember a conversation we were having in the newsroom around race, and we were pitching stories. And I pitched a story called Go Talk to Your Cousins, the idea that white people had to go talk to white people, that there's some spaces on this issue that I couldn't go into, and I thought about that. And as I read your book, I thought, is that the wrong impulse? Because we see that over and over again, that changing minds isn't worth it. Either you're not worth it, you're beneath me, or it's not going to make a difference, so why bother? That this impulse is running through a lot of us.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's really an honor to have people who choose books over baseball here, and an honor to be in Philadelphia. I have such respect for the city and the history of it, and thank you for doing this conversation. Feels fitting always to talk about democracy here. I think for me, this inquiry into persuasion and the changing minds, whether with cousins or coworkers or your fellow citizens, started with a profound despair that I imagine many of you have felt in the last many years, which is we see the country going in this incredibly dangerous direction. Not a traditional debate between high taxes and low taxes, this kind of healthcare and that kind of healthcare, but a debate about whether we are going to be a continued and expanded liberal democracy or not, whether we're going to go in a direction of kind of political violence or not, whether we're going to go in a direction, frankly, now of fascism or not. And as that trajectory got worse and worse, it seemed to me that my side of that argument, which is to say people who want more democracy, more human rights, a habitable planet rather than not habitable, were not winning the battle for hearts and minds. Sure, there's a lot of rigging going on. There's a lot of tampering going on. There's Steve Bannon's army of, you know, election fiddlers running for low-level things to, you know, throw out some of your votes. But in addition to that, and somewhat more disturbingly, I actually think we're not winning objectively the argument for whether these ideas of democracy and liberty and justice for all are better ideas. When I look at opinion polls that suggest, you know, 46-46 on these things, I mean, it's hard to blame the Electoral College. It's just a poll. They're just calling people at home, saying, do you support candidates who think the last election, you know, bogus claims about the last election, or do you support people who support a reality-based view of what happened in the last election? Are you fine with candidates proposing violence as a legitimate solution to public disagreements, or do you prefer people who don't do that? And it's neck and neck. It's neck and neck. I find it hard to blame, you know, the outdated Senate structure on that. We are losing, or at least struggling to win, the battle for hearts and minds on whether we are going to continue trying to be the more perfect union we set out to be in this city. So the question of persuasion then came to the fore for me of why aren't we winning this conversation, right? You can deplore Donald Trump all you want. You can, you know, make fun of Steve Bannon's appearance all you want. You can criticize these moves that are being made and these schemes, and you can have investigative journalism, you know, courageously calling out these machinations. But at the end of the day, you have to persuade more people to want the things you want if we're going to beat this thing. And so I became curious about why we were not doing that and what it would take to do that. And I didn't have the answers in my own heart. If I did, I would have written an autobiography. So I did what I do, which is report. And I went out and I spent time, looked for really a bunch of people who I was told were doing this, mm-hmm. where most of us are not doing it so well. We're able to move people, able to build bigger coalitions, hold together bigger coalitions, able to win over different types of people than them, able to have hard conversations, able to really change minds, to persuade in ways that I think most of us are struggling to, whether it's the climate denier uncle, whether it's the neighbors, whether it's, you know, in macro politics. And I really spent much of the last few years with those people, those mind changers in activism, in elected politics, in the cognitive scientist was one of the subjects of this book. A cult deprogrammer is one of the subjects of this book, because that's where we are in America today. But above all, organizers. This is a book about organizers and kind of organizers' method. And I think what I found, I was not hopeful at the beginning of reporting this book. I come away from reporting the book incredibly hopeful, because I found a kind of organizer's way, a persuader's way, that frankly is fundamentally different than what I was doing, maybe than what many of you are doing, what many of our politicians are doing, what Joe Biden's doing. A lot of well-meaning people are doing it wrong right now, are doing it in ways that almost seem designed to make this anti-democratic, anti-freedom movement grow even bigger. And so I studied this organizer's playbook and tried to learn from them what we can all do to beat back this menace and kind of make this country become what it has never been but still can be. And we can get into the playbook tonight, but at the heart of it, it depends on refusing this culture of the write-off that you mentioned, refusing this culture of saying people can't change their minds, they can't change their ways, they are who they are, they think like this because they're that race, they think like that because they voted for that person once, they think like that because they once said this thing about the vaccine. That attitude is empirically false. People change their minds all the time. If you are, you know, older than 12, you remember what positions on gay rights were like 5 minutes ago in the history of this country?
And you would have never thought we'd be here.
Never thought, right? So many people have said to me, you know, get older gay adults, like, if you had asked me when I was a teenager, what year would we have gay marriage in, right? We got there decades faster than I thought as a gay teenager, these people said. And so persuasion is possible, and believing in it, I think, is necessary, urgently necessary to the work of getting this country back on track. And so this is a kind of field manual for how to do that.
There are a couple of different elements of it. One that multiple stood out to me. In the beginning, you talked to a number of people who, in essence, they're willing to accept imperfection in themselves and in other people. Linda Sarsour, I'm not sure if I'm saying her name correctly, says to you, the thing about our movement is we're too woke. And there becomes this perfectionism that either somebody is getting it completely right or they're out, and then they're fighting with each other on social media. They have no time to think about the people that they're really arguing with because they're arguing with each other. And Loretta Ross, another person that you talk to in the book, says something interesting. This calling out culture isn't new. She talks about calling in, but she talks about something they were doing when she was young, where you'd have these meetings where people would go through things and you'd rectify it and move on. She said, we essentially have the calling out without the calling in. And why are we not able to do that? Why is it we'd rather fight with people on Twitter and I'm never talking to you again and I think you should leave the face of the earth versus let's work this out and move on?
Yeah, I'm so glad you highlighted both Linda and Loretta. This book, first of all, I should say, and I don't make a big thing about it in the book, but it is a book largely about women and largely about women of color who are at the forefront of some of these methods of persuasion that I think we all can learn from. And this first chapter is Linda, Loretta, and Elisa Garza, one of the progenitors of Black Lives Matter. And what all of them say, including the two you cited, they express in different ways a concern that the movement for progress that they belong to, for greater inclusion, greater justice, greater a bigger we, that this movement sometimes, often perhaps, is in love with smallness, as Alicia says. You know, that there's that it almost functions in the way of like music fandom, where if too many people join liking my album, then I'm no longer gonna like my album. My album is discredited by too many people liking it. Now, that may work in music. That is a really crappy attitude in politics, right? And so, you know, Alicia said this very eloquently in that same chapter. She says, you know, sometimes those of us who kind of have radical visions of housing for all or healthcare for all or a world where police don't hurt and kill people, we sometimes look around and say, oh gosh, there's some non-radical people entering our space. And Alicia's like, I don't understand what we're doing. That's the whole point. You're only winning when non-radical people are entering your space. That's not the problem. And she said, a lot of my allies are confused into thinking that that's the problem. And so, you know, when Linda talks about our movement's too woke, by the way, to be very clear, in case you don't know these people, this is not some Fox News critique of wokeness. Mm-hmm. These are some of the wokest people in the country talking. And there's a reason I started with the three of them. Right? These are people who no one could say are like mushy, milquetoast, moderate, you know, people who don't want real change. These are all people whose real change credentials are beyond dispute, who've gone to jail many times for real change, who have laid down in traffic for real change. However, Linda says, sometimes it feels like to people, and by the way, in politics, feelings become facts. If it feels this way, it is this way, effectively. It feels to many people like getting into the progressive movement is like getting into a prison where you have to get through four doors, and like the first door has to close behind you before the second door will open. And, you know, she's referring to, you have to know the right stuff, you have to have the right terms, you have to just have a level of sophistication to not be called out or just even just feel like you're okay in the space, right? And one of the questions that she and I discussed with the others, is there space among the woke for the still waking, right? There's a distinct, like Loretta says this so brilliantly in the chapter. She's like, we are not good at recognizing the difference between people who are trying to kill us and people who use the word wrong. And she's very clear, again, she's like, both are problematic. Right. I'm not one of these people saying pronouns don't matter. Pronouns really, really matter. However, if you can't tell the difference between someone who would prefer you don't exist and a slightly elderly teacher in your college who doesn't always get this new stuff right, you're going to be probably killed by that person over there at some point, right? That it's just bad threat assessment, as she calls it. So she's calling for a kind of progressive movement that has better threat assessment, you know? And then Loretta talks about calling in and calling out, and she's actually working on a book that will come out at some point soon, I hope, about calling in and calling out. And she says, again, not a right-wing critique, you know, she says, look, our culture has gotten to this place where we see someone who thinks differently from us, we just go straight to calling them out. And the problem is, again, it makes the movement hard to join, it makes the cause hard to join. She says, we got to do call-ins, not call-outs, which is not to say we should say nothing. Right? Silence is not the opposite of a call out for her is not silence. It's not letting it go. It's not letting people say awful things at work and in movement spaces or whatever. A call in is a call out done with love, she says. You still raise the thing. You still explain how you are made to feel by other people. That's what makes, you know, the political left not like the right. It's not a cult. You know, it's okay to have fights. Families fight, movements fight. But let's create a space for us to be able to talk about these things. And lastly, I would say, let us actually build a movement that is self-confident enough, to go to your first point, that we know we can take people who don't quite get it and teach them inside the tent. They don't have to stay in their bedroom, fully reform themselves, learn all the terminology, a full reckoning as a white person, or like a full reckoning with patriarchy as a man, and then ring the doorbell of your movement. Because then it's going to be a really small movement, right? Let them come into your movement and have a movement that is self-confident enough to teach people in its own tent.
You know, as I read the book, I thought some of this is primal, that it feels as though conservatives are saying, you don't have to do anything. Be afraid of who you want to be afraid of. Say what you want to say. This is easy. Show up a lot, show up a little. Whereas the other side, it feels like work. The language can be wonky. The ideas can be difficult. Is part of this just sheer laziness?
I mean, that's really true, but I think there's another twist to it. I think you're absolutely right. So the part that I think is very true about that is, in many ways, the work of the right, the project of the right now is really to cater to a minority of Americans who would rather break the country than share it in a time of demographic change and gender progress and other forms of opening up of liberty and justice for all. And so that's a really straightforward project. And all you have to do, and the kind of institutions we have help, you don't even need a majority, you need something shy of a majority. And you can go around and just say, like, didn't you like it before these people could get so mouthy? And didn't you like it before, you know, didn't you like it before? And people can finish the rest of the sentence in their own head. That's a relatively easy pitch. And you're right that the job of the political left is to say, okay, we're going to have to all live completely differently to save the planet. Who's ready? You know? Or and that's just one issue, you know? And yeah, a whole bunch of people with colors other than white actually didn't feel that great for the first several hundred years of American history. We know that now because we have Twitter, and, you know, that has been made clear. And so we have to now build a completely new kind of society that recognizes and treats them well and structures that include them and empower them the way some people were empowered. That feels like homework. Half of society, women, were, you know, essentially locked out of most opportunities to fully realize themselves for most of human history. Last 50 years, we realized that's a big problem. Got to stop that. So let's get on that as quickly as possible. China, very poor country. 34 years ago, not really in anyone's way. Now, apparently, China is going to make everything in the world, and all of you people who used to make things, that's no longer what you're going to be doing. Sorry, your sources of esteem and meaning and everything will be changed in a, you know, three-year period starting in the year 2000 or whenever we started trading with China. Over and over again, like, we're pushing people through quite a ringer right now. Now, it's a mix of bad things, climate, shocks like China, and then very good things, racial progress, gender progress. But people are being asked, the political left, the pro-democracy side writ large, you are right, is asking people to endure a lot of change, to change themselves, to change a lot of things. And is that a harder ask than saying, would you like to go back to Leave It to Beaver? Yes. However, and here's the twist. I actually think there's quite a record in politics of people, voters, citizens, not just being willing to sacrifice, but actually liking being summoned into something hard if they are asked correctly. If they are, I mean, those of you old enough to have lived through wars, like, it's so interesting if you read histories of World War II, you know? The memory that people will testify to is not always just like, that was such a pain to live through, right? There's a subjective experience in many cases of like, we were all in this thing, and our husbands were over there, and we were doing this, and like, it sucked in some objective sense, and we were in this thing, and our leaders were calling us to do something, right? And you think about now, I think part of the problem I have, the critique I have with some of our well-meaning leaders is they're asking us to go through all of this, but not really summoning us into any of it, right? They're kind of just like doing it piecemeal, like do this policy, this and that. And the right actually understands how much of a series of psychological transitions Americans are being asked to go through. The right doesn't like those transitions and has devoted itself to essentially inflaming people's stress and anxiety around these transitions. And I think whether it's Joe Biden, whether it's Democrats in general, there's a kind of, on the other side, a failure to narrate us through this, right? Even inflation. There's a reason inflation's happening. It sucks, right? Not as bad as living through World War II, right? But talk us through it. Explain that there's an epic struggle for democracy in this world, that Vladimir Putin did a bunch of things that we can't control, that he's actually also tried to sabotage our democracy, not just Ukraine's, that if we can pull together and help get each other through this time of crisis, people coming together, doing mutual aid, doing all amazing things Americans are doing to help each other, like, we can beat this thing. Same with climate, same with, you know, it would be amazing to hear Joe Biden, 78-year-old white man, talking to, as you were talking about the cousins thing, talking to white America about, here's why you're going to those trainings at work that might irritate you. There's a reason you're actually going through. It's a really good reason, right? Here's why your kid are coming home and saying, Mommy, is America a bad country? Kids are coming home and asking that. Liberal kids, kids of liberals, kids of conservatives. There's new stuff being taught in schools, thankfully. Kids are coming home asking those questions. The right is talking people through that. The right knows your kids are coming home and asking that. Is Joe Biden talking us through? And I'm not just putting it on Joe Biden. Like, is the political left generally talking Americans through these larger things, telling a galvanizing, thrilling story of why we have to go through what we're going through, and summoning us to sacrifice, to struggle, but also see the world they're trying to deliver on the far side of change.
I want to talk about, my favorite chapter was the one about Anant Shankar Arsoryo, who he describes as being the Frank Lutz of the left, because this is exactly what she talks about, that it's not just what you say, it's how you say it. This is all critically important. And I want to get into a couple of the things that she talks about. One of the things that, you know, you're seeing right now in the political season, you know, everybody's now all of a sudden in between calling each other the worst ever and snakes and the whole bit, running these. Dr. Oz has an ad saying, I want us to compromise. I want us to come together. Moderates are always being told, or politicians are told, camp towards the middle. And Anant says that is the wrong way to think about it, that she describes it as somebody wants a pizza or a burger. You've got to figure out whether to sell them on let's get pizza or burger. If you offer them a pizza burger, that's not really what they want. And that's what Democrats are doing. They keep trying to come up with a pizza burger rather than truly energizing the base of people who would go out there and say, oh, my God, I found the best pizza.
I'm so happy you brought up the pizza burger. Anant Shankar Arsoryo is, as I describe in the book, the Frank Luntz of the left, if the left listened to its Frank Luntzes, which is a major difference. She is the most brilliant messaging, kind of language expert on the political left. She works, she's the leading person for movement spaces, activist spaces, a lot of the kind of progressive advocacy groups, outside groups. The only place she doesn't quite have a foothold in is the very core of the Democratic Party power, because she's probably a little threatening to them. And she is in many ways running a one-woman insurgency against their method of persuasion. Their method of persuasion, their reigning Democratic Party method in our lifetimes, is persuasion through dilution. Persuasion through dilution is, like, I generally take at face value that a Bill Clinton or a Barack Obama or a Joe Biden, like, doesn't want to take away your health care, or doesn't want to, you know, like, they generally start with, I think, noble goals, philosophical goals, health care for everyone, right? And then what happens is there's this fear, and this is like in Pennsylvania, this is like such a resonant thing. There's this fear of the working class white voter. Right, like no one's interested in like Philadelphia voters, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like you got, it's like all these voters just a little bit to the west of you and north of you. It's like, oh, what do they feel? What do they feel? You must always feel so snubbed. The whole country talking about these voters, like all the voters in Pennsylvania except the ones who live in Philly. And it's because they're this like working class white voter fetish. Like there's actually a lot of persuadable voters. There's a lot of voters who move around. Like, Hispanic men are moving all over the place politically right now, right? But no one ever talks about any of these other swing voters. It is always working class white voters, preferably in Pennsylvania. And the fear is that, you know, those working class white voters often, like, feel like Democrats are communists. And so what you take this noble goal, healthcare for everyone, you add a lot of water to it, it becomes this very thin gruel. And then you go to Western Pennsylvania and you offer this really watery gruel to these supposed moderates, working class white voters. And you're like, here, I really watered down the gruel. Like, it, I swear it's not communism. And they just look at you and they're like, still communism. You know? They always still think you're a communist. This is the problem. Like, there's no amount of water that you can add to the gruel that makes those people think you're not a communist. But now what has happened is your base, maybe back in Philadelphia or elsewhere, is just really sad. They're really sad because you're not really doing meaningful health care anymore, right? I'm on Obamacare. Like, I've gone to the doctor so many times, and like I didn't quite check if the person coming in to give me a test was on the same insurance as the doctor I visited, and this is like a random $6,000 bill. It's like that's our big, I mean, like, no offense to all the people who worked hard on that, but like random $6,000 bills because you didn't like verify the test person in the doctor's visit doesn't feel to me like a major moral revolution. And we get that because we're fetishizing this moderate. And Anant Shankar Osorio essentially says we are all wrong about the moderate. The moderate, this idea of the moderate is based on the idea, this fantasy, that there are, that people who are undecided all sit at the exact midpoint between the two extremes. There are these two poles, liberal, conservative, right, left, government, market, whatever. And moderates, the people you're still trying to, still in play, they're all just sitting right in that line. And they all want the average, the pizza burger of these two things. It's just not true. Empirically not true, as Anant and many other people have shown. What people who are, better term for them is persuadables, people who move around, people who vote for Trump and then vote for Obama, or people who, you know, love a strong border but think we should have universal health care, right? I mean, those are people who don't fit neatly into the camps. Their defining property is not their middleness or their desire for something average. It's their tornness. It's their lack of a clear grounding in a totalizing worldview. They basically don't know what they think about everything yet. And they can be, as Anant says, toggled into very progressive moral frames and very conservative moral frames, right? To give you practical examples, this is a group of people where if they see images after images of asylum seekers flooding the border and images of a seemingly out of control border, this group can easily be toggled into a very right-wing kind of view of you don't have a country if you don't have a border, right? Like, we have to have people on horses at the border now, like, get some horses there. And if that same group of people sees images of the Trump administration separating mothers from babies at the border, and that is elevated into the scandal it deserves to be, those same people can completely toggle into a progressive understanding and vote for people who are vowing to shut that down, calling that out for what it is, right? Issue after issue. These are people who, when you ask, do we need to talk less about race in this country so we can move forward, that 75% say yes. Gotta move forward, gotta leave that stuff in the past. If you ask, do we need to talk more about race because you can't move forward if you don't confront your past, 75% of people say yes. Any mathematicians in the room? And so what Anant says is that winning over moderates is not about moderating what you believe. It is about toggling them into your understanding instead of having the other side. And what does that is not moderating. It is making them perceive your moral frame, your worldview, as more normal around them, as what people think, as the thing people do, as what people around them and they do, what people in their town do, what people of their class do, what people of their race do, whatever. Just normal, right? This is now my spin on it, not Anant's, and I don't know if this would embarrass her, but I think in some ways a moderate, again, a persuadable is a better term, comes to a position on something like immigration more in the way people choose pants than the way people like answer an essay question, right? You choose pants not based on like an analysis of like, okay, my legs are this big, this shape, these are the prices right now, right? You're kind of like looking around like, are we doing skinny jeans anymore? Is that over? Is that only Gen Z for whom it's over? Like, are we doing loose now? Are we doing belt? Like, what do we do, right? Like, you buy pants with some kind of very inchoate sense of like, what are we doing now, right? And I don't think it actually demeans people to say, like, that's kind of how a lot of us actually arrive at our ideas in life. Certainly people who are less politically engaged, people who do not live and breathe this stuff, people who maybe today would be choosing a baseball game over a book event. And no shade to that. If that's the case, what you got to do for those voters in Western Pennsylvania, but then all the other moderate voters of all the other colors, is actually just to encircle them with people who cannot shut up about how great the thing you want is. Which is why, for example, the student debt policy will have way more political power than the Inflation Reduction Act, even though that was so important. No one's life was transformed by the Inflation Reduction Act this year. No one's life may be transformed by it in the next 10 years. The whole planet may be saved by it eventually. Different thing. But a lot of people, the most important thing that happened in their life happened this year. And when they go home for Thanksgiving later this month, a lot of people are just going around the table saying what they're thankful for, are going to talk about 20 grand just disappearing from a debt website that they used to nervously check for the last 20 years, right? And a lot of uncles who don't like Joe Biden otherwise but love their niece are going to feel something, maybe, when their niece talks about the best moment, the most stress-relieving moment, the moment that he finally got her out of her funk at the Thanksgiving table. So I think this notion of rethinking the moderate is so crucial to winning in this age. We have to get over this idea of the thin gruel, the water in the soup, and in fact make people excited to come on board. And you do that by actually doing some of the things your most passionate supporters would go sing from the rooftops about if you made them happy.
She has some other great ideas, like getting into arguments with the other side does you no good because you're on their playing field, and if somebody's evaluating you, they're going to always be choice A. You're going to be choice B. And I actually wanted to read an example from the book quickly because it's something that affected us here. You give the example of Joe Biden going to Kenosha after all the things that went on there, and he ran an ad, and I'll give you a quick reading of what the ad said versus what she would have said to say, because I think for people it really brings it home. I want to make it absolutely clear, the ad begins, rioting is not protesting, looting is not protesting, it's lawlessness, plain and simple, and all those who do it should be prosecuted. And they're grim images. Fires are burning, and we have a president who fans the flames. He can't stop the violence because for years he's fomented it. Violence will not bring change. It'll only bring destruction. It's wrong in every way. And it's Armageddon in this commercial. And here's an example of what she said. And because there had also, in the aftermath of Jacob Blake being shot, there had been a birthday party. There had been all these things where the community came together. And she said the Democrats lost a moment to talk about it. What if the ad had said, no matter what we look like or where we're from, we want our families to be safe, our voices to be heard, and rights to be respected. But Trump is trying to divide and scare us into silence by sending federal forces into our communities, stopping people from protesting and provoking aggression. With the election coming up, he hopes to distract us from his corruption and failure to ensure that we have the care, services, and support that we need during this pandemic. By joining together black, white, and brown to demand liberty and justice today and to vote in record numbers in this election, we can swear in a government of, by, and for the people. And you would have seen a multiracial group of people coming together, happiness. Yes, you've seen these terrible things, some of which we saw in Philadelphia, but this is a reality out there. And I thought she really made it plain. This is, and she could have said that. She could have written that out in a minute if they had just asked her.
Totally. And there are two, I want to just tease out two very quick lessons from that that we can all learn from, and even if you're not a Democratic, you know, ad maker. Number one, do not have the other side's conversation. Have the conversation you want to be having, right? So if I say, if someone says, immigrants are animals, and I respond, immigrants are not animals. Well, first of all, I'm correct. I won that argument. however, I have consented through my reply to have a really terrible conversation. I have gotten into a conversation whose topic is the animalness of immigrants. It doesn't matter that I'm against that idea. That's now the pool that we're in. That's the pool I'm swimming into. And those words, just like think about keywords on the internet, like immigrant, animal, like I'm elevating the linkage of those keywords in the public mind, right? So when Joe Biden, again, because of that anxiety about the white working class vote, like I know where it comes from. He's not trying to do a bad thing, right? Rioting is not protesting, law and order, right? He is elevating. There's a lot of things you could say in that moment, right? He is elevating the notion that America is unsafe. That, he's putting his own spin on it. He's blaming Trump for it. But he's elevating just the notion that America is unsafe right now, which is a highly disputable notion in that moment. There's a few things in a few places. The country was not unsafe in that moment. And as Anat says, when you activate that notion that the country is unsafe, they're never going to go for Joe Biden if safety is the most salient issue for them. They're not going to go for what she calls the flabby B-minus alternative on safety. They're going to go for who's the best avatar of safety. And the right is going to always own that issue, right? The second thing, so have your conversation, not that. And by, this is for all of us who, you know, I just look at my tweets. My tweets all day long are like well-meaning people on the left quote tweeting awful things said by the right and just putting their little three-word spin on it. Well, I'm sorry, your three-word spin isn't compensating for the fact that you're just amplifying these talking points all day long. We all do it. I do it. Have your conversation, not theirs. And second, paint the beautiful tomorrow, right? What she wanted, the ad she wanted, was the script you read overlaying images of black activists in Kenosha grilling, doing a bouncy castle, doing voter registration, hugging each other in celebration of Jacob Blake's life several days after they also marched. And paint the beautiful tomorrow. Tell people the world you want. And then tell people who is obstructing getting that world. Why? The why is very important. Crimes need motives. Why they are obstructing getting that world. What's in it for them? How they work. But tell people what the world looks like if you win. If I reflect honestly on the people in politics today who I respect, who are fighting for the world I most want, I struggle to think as a writer and storyteller of any vivid description I have heard from any of them of what it would look like to have Medicare for All, not just telling me Medicare for All is good. What would like life be like if none of you had to think about your health insurance ever again? What would your marriages be like with that kind of stress reduction? What businesses would you start that you've been tossing around in your head for a decade if you wouldn't lose health coverage by starting a company the way people in Europe can go start companies all day? We think we're the capitalists. They can go start a company anytime in Europe and they still just have health care. Most of us can't start the businesses we think of. Just can't. It's irresponsible to our children. What would happen? What would the world look like if we win? That question, I think, is at the center of what a invigorated pro-democracy, pro-freedom movement needs to do to win.
And just pro tip, she says, when you talk about Donald Trump, talk about him as a sore loser who wants to flip over the table. When you say things like coup and all authoritarian, it sounds like a strong guy, and he likes that. And again, it's playing on his field. We're going to go to your questions in just a moment. We have an election coming up next Tuesday, and if you've watched TV for 5 minutes here, you know the Democrats are really getting mauled on crime and the economy and you name it. And what people are going to say, if indeed John Fetterman loses, will be that, or other people lose, is that the Democrats did not figure out a way to talk about crime, did not figure out a way to talk about the economy or the other things the Republicans used to go after that moderate. What would you say instead that they should have done, and do you disagree with that assessment?
No, I think it's very true. And one of the, I think, mantras, I wrote a, you know, the book is really stories of people doing this work, but I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times called The New Playbook for Saving Democracy that was trying to mine like six things Democrats and their allies need to do, you know, kind of a new playbook for dealing with this. And one of them, one of the six items was meet people where they are. And something organizers in particular talk about a lot. It sounds kind of vanilla, but in the context of this year of voter anxieties about crime and prices, it's a very specific thing, which is, I think Democrats have, you know, Anat calls it a responsibility complex to tell people what they really should be caring about. I would call it Dem-splaining. It's sort of like a... So a voter is like standing in front of you. It's like, my street feels unsafe and I can't afford anything. And there's this tendency that I see on TV 5 times a day, on Twitter 150 times a day, which is basically goes as follows. Totally get that you think crime is high right now, but actually if you look at this regression, it's adjusted for bloobity blobity boo. It's not, in fact, you are not, your street is fine. Second, totally hear you on the prices. It must suck to be a normal person like you, but if there's no democracy, there is no prices. So here's this other issue that is actually, I got my wares here. I got my democracy I'm selling. I'm also selling fixing climate change. Please buy this. And like, I hear you on the prices, but like, who cares about prices if the climate makes the planet, right? And it totally comes from a good place, right? Because at some level, it is true that if there's no democracy, like, gas prices may recede in one's imagination if one is living in like a really, you know, dystopian, tyrannical future. And it is true that climate hovers over all these things. But you can't say that to voters. You can't talk to voters like that. You can't demsplain. What you have to do is connect the agenda you have into and back it into the fears and anxieties that people have. And take them, as Loretta Ross says, take people's fears seriously. Take people's fears seriously. Do not tell them they're wrong about their fears. Do not explain to them why a regression disproves their fears. People's fears are going to be very real to them. By the way, that's true about completely irrational fears, and it's true about rational fears like inflation. And then, in a way that, frankly, has not been done enough, explain how, if Republicans win, it's easier for corporate monopolies to raise prices further. They love Vladimir Putin, so that's going to not be helpful. So on and so forth. All the way they're going to do tax cuts for wealthy people instead of actually, you know, regulate companies properly and prevent them from price gouging, so on and so forth. But there, we have to stop this thing of the thing you are telling me you're concerned about is in fact not as important as the thing in my jacket. And I really, really, in the next few days, that's going to just be really, really crucial to be able to land that message. And the last thing I'll say, there's a lot of different formulations of it. Justice Democrats, great group, helped elect AOC, actually put out a statement tonight ahead of Biden's democracy speech, which was really good. I caught a lot of it backstage, in which Justice Democrats said, you got to find a way to connect the democracy issue to pocketbook issues, and Justice Democrats offered some interesting, helpful language. But for those of you who saw Barack Obama's campaign appearances over the weekend, he did, I mean, first of all, obviously he's just quite talented. But it wasn't just his generic talent, and it wasn't just his oratorical ability, which is always good. There was something in the structure of the argument that was actually unusual and powerful, which I think he framed, he turned the temperature down a little bit on the fascism stuff, even like compared to what I'm saying now. And, you know, different people are going to have different approaches. He didn't frame it so much as, like, this, like, looming awful tyranny. So maybe he didn't do that thing of, like, making them sound more big and powerful than they are. We can disagree about that. But what that allowed him to do was then say, he kind of cast all the stuff under the fascism rubric as kind of, like, nuttiness. They're doing all this nutty stuff instead of solving your problems, right? And it was really different from what I've heard from most. Like, he was just treating everything from disinformation, QAnon, to election denial, to just like, they just like have this whole other bunch of stuff that like, it's really important to them to do. And like, they just like probably are not devoting a lot of hours to thinking about your gas price because they can't, because they're just like so busy doing this other crazy stuff, right? And I thought it was a sort of like, turning down the temperature way of warning of this stuff without getting into the flares of fascism, democracy, this and that, and just like can these people really help you if they're like so busy doing this other weird stuff? And I thought it was very, very effective.
What would you have told them to do on crime? Because the obvious thing to do would be to say, do the Joe Biden, we're going to shut it down, we're going to stop the crime. But you're saying that's playing to their argument. What should they have said this season on crime?
I mean, it's very hard, but like part of it is like part of why there's, you know, these crime statistics are like very complicated to prove what causes what. But we all know there's like measures of desperation and poverty and insecurity and lack of housing that are strongly correlated with people living harder lives and being driven to desperate situations. And you can talk about how you have an agenda to reduce the root causes of suffering that may be responsible for some of that. You can talk about how you know, the kind of policing that you would advocate is really different from a kind of policing that is based on, you know, shooting people in the back as they run away without weapons. Doesn't make anyone safer. I think you can talk about a kind of education programs and other things that would provide a more comprehensive notion of well-being in communities from the cradle to the grave for everyone, and not singularly fixate on criminals as this kind of boogeyman that the right loves to elevate. It's not an easy issue. And both prices and crime, just like historically around the world, are very, very tough. And I think it's very important, as Obama did in some of those appearances, to say, like, the other side has literally no interest in making this problem better, right? These are hard problems, but the other side has zero interest in making them better. And we are the side that is trying to fix these things. And we need authority to fix them if we're gonna be able to make your life better.
Any questions in the crowd right there?
I loved your previous book, Winner Take All, and I wish I could be as optimistic as you are, but the problem I see, and you being part of the media, this is not to bash the media, but there have been, I don't know, in the last election, 30, 40 articles on the guy in Western Pennsylvania in the diner, right? No one ever interviews people in West Philadelphia. Nobody ever interviews people in North Philadelphia to see how crime affects them, how these Republican policies. So, and then if you go into any kind of tire place, gas station, there's Fox News on. You're captive. You can't get away from that. So how can the media sort of help get that message out? There's never follow-up questions asked. They have Republican people on Meet the Press. There's never a follow-up question when somebody says something outrageous. Nobody ever holds anybody accountable. So part of the Democratic messaging is because the media feels they have to both sides everything, when sometimes there isn't both sides. Sometimes there's just right and wrong. And so what's the answer to that?
I share your concern as a longtime card-carrying member of the media. I worked for the New York Times for 11 years. I still write for it occasionally. I think a lot of our media, a lot of media that I have written for and believe in generally and was my training and formation, are unwittingly helping to kind of sleepwalk us toward fascism. I don't think that's their goal. I don't think it's their project. I think what I just said would, you know, I know it would horrify them. I have these conversations with people. I think it's easy for me to also say that on the outside. It's a very hard problem that they're in, which is basically American journalists were not trained for the situation we are now in. They were not trained for two things, I would say. They're not trained for basically disinformation at this scale, velocity, and with this level of institutional backing, where basically one of the two major parties is now a conspiracy theorist party, whose major ideas are fictional, right? The Republican Party is like a novelist now. No American journalist, unless you were like in the Soviet Union in the eight, like, it just wasn't the training. It just wasn't what happened at Columbia Journalism School or University of Missouri Journalism. That's just what, right? Maybe it should have been like, it just wasn't the training. Second, and I'm super critical of this both sides thing, but again, it helps me to understand like where it comes from. these papers, I mean, you know, I have a newsletter. Like, it's lasted 2.5 years. Like, we'll see. You know, there's a reason the New York Times has lasted 150 years. There's a kind of sobriety. There's a kind of, like, not getting jumpy at each thing. There's a kind of, like, taking a long view. You know, it's easy. You can squander the legitimacy of an institution like that in two sentences, right? To keep something like that for 150 years that has that level of influence and credibility requires, like, never messing up or messing up as seldom as possible. And so there's this profound caution in these newsrooms to not ever be perceived as on a side. And I think in that caution, they have basically accidentally become handmaidens of an increasingly mendacious and autocratic right, because they won't call lies lies until they agree to do so, or because it's hard to get them to. I mean, I wasn't allowed to use the word demagogue in an article in 2016 about Trump. I mean, I just think that's a word with an objective meaning. It either means something or it doesn't mean something. I don't think there's any dispute that Trump was a demagogue, you know. And so I'm very clear that this is a huge problem, but I don't think it's an easy problem, because I think if the New York Times were to be perceived, it's already quite badly perceived, but people on the right still fundamentally respect it in a way that they may not say on Fox News. Still take the calls, they still respond to the reporting, they still want their books on the New York Times bestseller list. If the Times were just to be universally perceived as like an organ of the DNC, it would be very, very bad for this country also. And so how that is resolved is, to me, it's one of the great, great, great questions of this country for all these papers, all these media outlets. It's very challenging. And the last thing I'll say is I have a whole chapter in the book about disinformation and what we need to do there. And I think there, actually, what I advocate in the book, based on two people I spend a lot of time with, is actually worrying less about shutting it all down, the disinformation down. I don't know that we're going to be able to do that. Instead, treating it as endemic and having a real program of basically a public health approach to it, where we educate people to be resistant to disinformation. This is the kind of next great educational revolution, the same way we added sex ed to education. We used to think, you know, if you got it from your family or you didn't get it at all, or you figured it out, you know, behind the shed. And then we realized it's actually better that everybody gets a certain basic minimum knowledge, and schools are going to do that because who knows what your parents are going to tell you, right? I think being able to resist not just critical thinking, that's like 101, like being able to resist organized manipulation by people like Rupert Murdoch and Elon Musk and others needs to basically become a core part of any human educational journey. And the people I write about in the book who are developing a program to basically make that a core curriculum for the human experience.
Hey, Anand, my name's Raj. I really appreciated your book. I'm also the son of Indian immigrants, and I wanted to ask a question about how interviewing and doing the research for this book has influenced you as a father relative to how your immigrant parents raised you.
Interesting. I mean, it's so interesting. Like, I've tried to explain my previous books to my... I have a 7.5-year-old and a 4.5-year-old. At partly age and partly nature. Like, the 4.5-year-old doesn't care. She also may not care when she's 7. But the 7-year-old is, like, really interested. Like, what do you write about? And I was like, you know, first book, like, Social Change in India, is kind of like, okay. Second one, like, Hate Crime in Texas, it's like, okay. Third one, like, billionaire, he's like, what's a billionaire? You know, it's like, let me tell you. And then this one, I was like, it's a book about how you convince people. He's like, oh, I do that a lot with Zora. And so I actually asked him, what are your methods of persuasion with Zora? He's like, for example, like, she wants to do Uno after school, and I want to do art in our room, and I gotta persuade her. I said, how do you do it? And he said, I have two methods. Sometimes I use one, sometimes I use the other, sometimes I use both together. I was like, what are they? He says, attract and distract. I was like, I think that's really similar to what I'm arguing in the book. Can you say more about that? He was like, attract is like, I'll just go over to where she's playing Uno, and I'll be like, oh, Zora, it's so interesting. There's such great art in my room. And then I'll run down the hallway to my room, and I'll just wait there and hope that she'll be so interested in what I'm doing. Then if that doesn't work, I'll go back to what she's doing, and I'll just point to different things and distract her from the Uno, and then hope that when she's ready for the next activity, she'll come and do art in the room. So attract, distract, attract, distract. So I always learn a ton from my kids. I think, you know, I mean, I was thinking a lot about my children as I wrote this book, because this little bit last, you know, the period of the pandemic, the period of such existential fear for the country, and frankly, like, whether they're going to be safe in their bodies in this country in the future. Like, you know, this is the period where, you know, 2015, we started talking about, could natural-born U.S. citizens be stripped of their citizenship for certain, like, crimes of dissent, which is the, you know, policy Trump advocated in 2015. I think they just give me a tremendous amount of motivation. I understand the people who are just like, I'm getting off Twitter, or I'm getting Portuguese citizenship, which apparently they're just handing out over there. I get it, and people have to do them, but I'm not leaving America. Like, I'm not quitting on America. I don't have any other country, even though I'm often told to go back to it online. I am all in on America, and I'm all in on America not only because of them, but partly because of them. And if it hasn't already been clear, like, I think we can win the future. Like, I think we can seize the age. I think these people are the same tired minority faction that has been against every advance of progress in American history. There was always some group that didn't want to end slavery. There was some group that didn't want women to vote. There was some group that, you know, didn't want civil rights. There was some group that didn't want to open immigration to a wider array of non-white countries in 1965. There's always been this group of people who would rather break the country than share it. And although we all feel a lot of despair right now, presumably, we have beaten those people every single time in the long run. Every time. Every time. You know, and it's worth remembering that. Like, these people, their record sucks in the long run. It really does. It really does. Like, they have only lost, right? And I think they're going to lose again. I think they're going to lose decisively. And I think in many ways this is a real last gasp movement, because it's actually all the things at once, right? It's a last gasp of a kind of pre-gender equality, a patriarchal thing, precisely because of how much progress we've made, right? It's a last gasp of people who want white to mean American and American to mean white and everybody else to be a guest, right? But it's a last gasp because of all the progress we've made on that, the way the country is different. Look at this room. It's a last gasp of a kind of nostalgia for when things were easy because, you know, in your town everybody looked like a cousin of yours. Well, that world is gone, and it's gone because we actually fought over a very long time to achieve something different. And more people consistently have fought for and supported that expansion, that more perfect union dream. And so all I want to do is to give that minority faction what they are most comfortable with, which is another stinging defeat. And I think we can do it. I think we will do it. I think we need to change our ways if we're going to do it. But thanks not least to my children, I have tremendous, tremendous hope.
Well, Anand, thank you for being with us. And you're going to be signing books as well.
I will
right?
be.
Okay. So hopefully some of you will come out and buy and get
thank
your
you.
Book signed.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.